Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We are on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
This season, we're taking a look at the people, products, and cookbooks that revolutionised Scotland's culture and cuisine.
Beginning at the very start of the Victorian era,
it's time to investigate our great Scots. So Lindsay's arriving in the next 5 minutes and we're going to record the podcast. It's the first time she's been to my house. And which is always slightly nerve-wracking. But anyway, I am going to be making up some bear meal bannocks to go with our chat today. For those who don't know, bannocks are essentially like a Scottish bread, and it's somewhere between like an oat cake and what you might imagine as being like an Irish soda bread. It's that type of thing. We're going to be having a chat today about Florence Marion McNeill, who was one of Scotland's most prolific food writers. And she wrote this book, which is still being reprinted today, called The Scots Kitchen. But she had such an interesting life before she even started writing books. So I think today we're going to enjoy some bannocks and chat about the life of Florence Marion McNeill. I think that's Lindsay now.
Oh, I love the colour of your hot. It's such a nice green. Wow!
Yeah.
Oh my God, ambiance.
Ambiance. This is, hold on, that's your seat, but I'm going to get in before you.
Wow.
Just ignore everything on the other side of the kitchen.
It's so beautiful.
That's the bomb site. Like, this is my, like, hoarding borrower's...
Is this a fridge?
It's a wine fridge.
Wow. But you use it as a fridge.
Use it as a fridge.
I quite like that. It would force me to be tidy.
You would think.
Oh, it's lovely.
So, I mean, yeah, this isn't the book collection. This is the, like, working book collection. The reference books are next door.
Yeah.
I do have some here.
This is entertaining. So I'm looking at Peter keeping his glasses in a meat grinder.
It was one of these, like...
Is it for tinned meat? And you would grind it up?
I have no idea. I think it's just a mincer.
You used to get them for tin meat specifically. That one does just.
I'm not
like
going to do that.
Mincer,
I'm going to start grinding books behind it. But it's like they kind of like perfectly fit in size.
Yep.
I'm also forever losing my glasses, so I have like
several pairs.
Several pairs everywhere. You can have a seat because I'm.
Thank you.
Or maybe we'll pour a glass of wine first. Actually,
pour a glass of wine. Shall I do the honors?
Please go for it. Happy New Year, Lindsay.
Happy New Year. It's the first time we've actually done this since 2025 began.
I do think January was approximately 300 days.
300 days and still counting.
I mean, it's, yeah, we're still in January. That is bonkers.
I know. I feel like I've had a whole year in this month.
I think it's for me, it's how poor I have been this month.
I know. I've not, like, my... The place I work is like very much if the last payday is a weekday, that's when you're getting paid. Yep. So it's a Friday. I've been crawling towards
And there is no real similarity. Mm. I want to acknowledge that at the top of this.
Yes.
However, this year I have, in talking about our ancestors and thinking about this like seasonality, I've written lots about how our ancestors were relying on the earth to give them food.
Mm.
And when that food ran out, they were waiting, they were counting down the days until milk would come back in, until weeds would start growing that they could eat.
Yep.
And I felt like this year, I've been writing about it whilst waiting.
You've been waiting for your
payday.
Weeds.
I've been like surviving on like pantry staples. It's been in all honesty, I had to eat lots of the food this month that I grew up eating when I was poor.
Oh, really? Interesting.
That has been a journey for me.
Mm.
And, like, just eating lots of toast.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, beans and tin food and things. Yeah. And, I, like, In the grand scale of things, I still eat that throughout a month.
Yeah, of course, but it's just not out of necessity necessarily.
I've never had to eat tinned food for breakfast, lunch and dinner.
Yeah.
Or cereal, toast and pasta.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was definitely, and like, I had to do a lot more baking this month if I wanted something sweet.
Mm.
So I was also like baking things for my family. So it's been an oddly like poetic, difficult, introspective month for me. But you had a more exciting January than I had.
This is going to now sound ridiculously awful and incredibly middle class.
I didn't even, because I know what story's coming.
You set me up for an absolute fail here. So, I mean, my January has also been long and hard. And, like, yeah, January is always difficult. But I had the pleasure and privilege of being away for a week in France with my family. And that was lovely. We were in the mountains. We were skiing. It just keeps getting more and more ridiculous. But the funny part of this was me having flown from Aberdeen to Geneva to then go up to the mountains in France. All was going well. It was a good travel day until I got to passport control in Geneva and realized I'd somehow lost my passport, which is very un-Lindsay behavior. And it was such a weird thing. I could sense before I'd even like checked my bag, I was like, it's gone.
Oh.
So
this is a waking nightmare.
Genuinely, I've never, like, you know that feeling when you have a dream that you've lost something, or you think you've lost something and then you found it and you have that pit of dread in your stomach. This was it actually realized. So anyway, my family went through the border because I assumed I'd left on the plane. So they were like, yeah, we'll call, they'll check, blah, blah. Anyway, I sat there for 4 hours and I had to keep like remembering myself to the people on the border, or not like, not the actual border control, but like people who were like, oh yeah, EU passports this way, all the arrest of you scum the other way. And it was, they checked the plane, they didn't find it. They checked the bus. Anyway, 4 hours later, I finally got actually presented to border control. And they were like, speaking in very serious French, the police came. It was like, I thank God I had a picture of my passport on my phone, and they eventually let me through. But they were like, you need to sort this out before you come home, because otherwise you won't be able to go.
I feel like they did look at you and go, she's probably fine.
Well, it was telling that they looked at me, and I can understand a certain amount of French if it's not spoken too swiftly. And he was like, is she over 18?
Right, yeah. No, I was going to say, because
I was so like worried that I must have lit like a crying child. Yeah,
no, but like
genuinely, it was very scary. Like, and I got through and it was completely fine. But then, yeah, I had to pay for my emergency travel document. And actually, one system that works well. It was great. They managed to get it to me. It was fine. Although, yeah, obviously expensive. And then, the police on the other side, when I'd not been through, told my mum that they were going to send me home.
Oh my God.
So, yeah, drama.
We're sending your child daughter back home to Aberdeen.
Like, I've never felt...
And your mum was like, she's a doctor, she'll be fine.
No, she wasn't. She was like, she is a child. I've never felt more like a child ever. But it was ridiculous. And then, because we'd flown into Switzerland, I was then having to cross the border into France. And I was like, oh, I'm paperless.
Oh my gosh.
By that point, I was like, I'm just embracing the drama.
Yeah. a vagrant to the world.
A vagrant. Paperless vagrant. Anyway, yeah. Made it back through, got my document, all good. But, yeah.
But what a January.
What a January.
And here we are to kick off the season two. Season two. A slight cop-out. Season one was 4 episodes.
I think that's fine. They were all about the festive period.
Yes, and actually there wasn't a way for us to move into season one part two and not talk about festivities
exactly.
Or whatever. So we just draw a line under it, a 4 mini-series, very well received by my parents.
Mine too, my mom loved it.
As you may be able to smell, there is a griddle sizzling behind me.
It smells very good in here.
We're going to be making some bear meal bannocks.
Ooh.
And I have an accompaniments to go with.
Okay.
For a little light graze.
Excellent.
Bear meal,
Bear meal. I'll guess.
Go for it.
Is it a sort of oat that still has the husk on it in some way?
It's a barley.
Oh, a barley. Yep.
So it's
very cool.
Like a ancient grain that we have been growing in Scotland for thousands of years.
Love that.
And the last place that still commercially grows it is Barony Mill.
Ah.
In Orkney.
Wow. Birthday, yeah.
Now, we have chosen an Orkney dish for tonight.
An Orkney dish.
And a bannock.
And a bannock.
Because we're going to be talking about Florence Marion fucking McNeil.
I love that, yep.
I mean, sorry, I'll say Florence Marion McNeil. I'll have to bleep out
Florence Marion McNeil. But we're putting respect in her name, which is much needed. I mean, there's a lot to say. She's quite a champion of a woman.
I mean, in my brief notes, I think I've got up to 1918.
Yeah.
So.
Busy woman.
Busy woman. But I'm going to get us started with some bear meal bannocks. If you will bear with me.
Oh, these look so good.
I think they're probably cooked now.
Mm. They smell good.
No, you have under no obligation to eat. Massive.
I haven't had dinner, so I'm kind of buzzing. But I did
pop along.
Ooh.
We're going to have a wee picnic.
Oh, stunning.
So I got some sweet cured mackerel.
Yum.
As a tinned food fanatic, I thought I need to provide for my guests. Some unsalted butter, just because. I also got some Orkney smoked cheddar with cracked black pepper.
Yum.
Made in Orkney. And I also got some fat cow from Tain.
Excellent.
Because I just wanted to buy some fat cow. Anyway, let me get a knife and we'll get ourselves sorted. So,
beautiful picnic.
I want to find out, when was the first time you came across Florence Marion McNeil?
That's a really good question. I think it was when I was doing my PhD and I was doing an internship with the National Trust to sort of help them reinterpret Scottish food and some of their properties. And I found like a real lack of good historical sources around Scottish food history. So there's one book which is like the kind of ethnographic Bible by Alexander Fenton.
Yeah.
And then the other one that I found that was just so useful, not only because it contained recipes, but also kind of the sources of those recipes, was The Scots Kitchen. And initially I got it out of the library and I was like, this is incredible. And I can't believe, as like, you know, by that, at that point, my focus wasn't predominantly or singularly on Scotland. I was studying kind of British food history more broadly. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't believe that as a food historian who lives in Scotland and loves Scotland, I hadn't heard of her.
Yeah, so I had Florence's book on my shelf, and it was The Scots Kitchen. And I think it might have actually... And I will say, I'm going to... A major shout out to Gina Lyle.
Yes.
Who has done a lot of work.
Hi, Gina. We love you, Gina.
Gina had done some work in compiling the story of Florence. Mm-hmm. And it was, I believe it was actually one of her articles that she had written where I actually first heard about Florence and her legacy. Mm. And then when it said The Scots Kitchen, I went, I think I've got that.
You've got that, yeah.
I had just started to get into buying secondhand Scottish cookery books. I now have a problem. But it all started with Florence. And very soon after, Sue Lawrence and Catherine Brown, and then kind of dived into the world of the Glasgow Cookery Book and Scottish Women's Institute and all these great kind of historic books. But yeah, I don't think I've ever met someone who has started to look into Florence and not instantly fall in love.
Yeah.
There is something about her story that I think endears her to anyone who reads, anyone who researches, and maybe we should get kicked off right in the beginning.
Yes.
So Florence was born in Holm, Orkney. I hope I'm saying that right. H-O-L-M, Holm.
That's how I pronounce it, but I wouldn't want to speak for Orkadian.
On behalf of Orkney, I hope it's Holm. Holm in Orkney. She was born in the Free Church Manse to Janet and Daniel. Now, her dad was a reverend doctor.
Reverend doctor?
Reverend doctor.
Double-barreled, wow.
I don't think, no, you can't have Dr. Reverend. It's Reverend Doctor, right.
Dr. Reverend. It sounds a bit too much like Dr. Feelgood.
Right, okay. her mum was Janet Dewar. Is that right? I can tell you here because I've got her birth certificate right in front of me. Yeah, Janet Jane Dewar. And Janet, her mum's dad was also a reverend. Mm-hmm. So I think the story is, because we don't have all these, we don't have in-depth details here, but I think that Florence's dad moved to the parish and met. Because her dad was initially from Campbelltown.
Wow.
That's actually quite important.
And also very, very far away to Orkney.
Very far away to Orkney, but her mum was from Fockabers.
Fockabers. Oh, I love Fockabers.
I did not, if you'd sat me down and asked me to guess how that was pronounced.
Fockabers. Yeah.
That is so brilliant. Florence was one of 12 children.
12?
12 children.
Wow.
She was number 8.
Wow. I feel like 8 of 12 is a hard place to be.
It's like the ultimate middle child. Yeah. If only you were number 6. But it's just like lost. You're not even special enough to be in the middle.
Yeah.
You're number 8.
Yeah. In the nether zone, in the liminal zone.
No, exactly. But, I mean, we don't have enormous amounts of detail about her life. Mm-hmm. But, unfortunately, we can paint a picture of tragedy.
Oh, okay.
Because her brother Arthur died when she's 4.
Oh, no. Was he younger or older, do we know?
He was younger.
Okay.
And her brother James died when she was 8.
Gosh.
And then when she was 11, her mum died.
Oh, no.
So
that's what then? 10 children?
Yeah.
And no mum?
And no mum.
Wow.
And of course, like, she's got much older sisters. Mm-hmm. They begin to take over responsibilities in the house. There's at least a secure income that's coming in. There's a manse, which obviously provides them with shelter. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily...
They're not without support.
They're not without support. Yeah. They also, like, we know that lots of the children, I believe 7 of the 12, went to university.
Wow.
So, like, an enormous amount of money had to go out on that.
Yeah, that is a very... Particularly for the time. So she was born, what, 1885?
1885.
So still in the Victorian period, you know, coming into the 20th century by the time maybe she was going to uni. So that's impressive in and of itself. But to send that many children to university is quite something.
Yeah. But we know that, and why I said it was important that her father came from Campbelltown.
Mm.
It's in the west of Scotland. It was essentially Gael land, where there's communities which have a much stronger sense of like ritual and mysticism and things.
Mm.
There's obviously a lot in the Highlands and Islands, but especially in the Western Isles.
Yeah.
When that was taken up to Orkney, that became part of their family's culture.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of notes about on Hogmanay, them and all the family would walk around the house anti-clockwise and to bring in the new year and lots of bits and pieces like that. And so her childhood was formed as part of this big family unit with mysticism and folklore
at its centre. So it's woven in from her very, like, upbringing,
I mean, and I'm sure that lots of places across Scotland have that. There is an audio clip, I'm not going to play it for you tonight, of Florence talking about her very 100% non-ironic belief in mermaids.
I don't know if I've ever heard her voice before.
There's one recording.
Wow.
That was found. Somebody from Orkney had a radio or mic set up, whatever, and had recorded Florence.
It's interesting to me that her family were from the church, but that folklore was still such an integral part of how she grew up. And I think that speaks a lot to how religion used to be more flexible back in the day.
In Orkney especially.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there was a lot of, in the rest of Scotland, the Church of Scotland versus the Free Church versus the Gaelic Church versus, we don't get Pentecostalism or anything like that yet, but we have lots of different kind of structures of churches. There was a note in the British newspaper archive about her dad being one of the kind of ministers that was very much open for combining churches, for removing boundaries and barriers.
So he had a more open mindset about this kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I think part of that is just when you have like folklore beliefs that don't necessarily match up with the Bible.
Yeah, you have to find a way to kind of make them speak to each other.
Or yeah, or at least it shows. Yeah, it shows that you, if you don't abandon those beliefs, it shows that you are open.
Yes.
To those, you know, to other things. But yeah, so the next kind of big kind of mention that we have of Florence is in the Orkney newspapers, and it's 1901, and it's her leaving certificate. Mm. So she graduates school, or at least when she's 16, she does her leaving cert, and she gets lower mathematics, higher English, lower French, and lower German.
Wow.
She's, I think, on the... I don't know how many children there are doing exams on the island.
Yeah.
But she is, I believe, number 8.
Okay. This is a high achieving
Or, like,
island.
Number 6th of all the girls on the island. Yeah. To, you know, not number 8 again. Florence, number 8. But, yeah, she does relatively well.
Mm-hmm.
She's not the best, but she clearly has applied herself.
Yeah.
She's got more than one subject that she's graduating with. We then believe that she studies in France and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what time she leaves. Obviously, she gets her leaving cert when she's 16. We don't really hear from her until she comes back to Glasgow in 1911.
That's a big thing to, like, be 16 at that time, turn of the century, and heading off to Europe.
I think you also I mean...
From Orkney. Yeah.
Has a childhood which is coloured in tragedy.
Yep.
Quite quick, successive... You
yeah.
know,
yeah.
two brothers passing and then your mum passing, the impact of that on a family, it obviously has galvanised something in all of them, because all of the McNeils,
mm-hmm.
as a group, as a clan, as a people, this family go on to do amazing things individually.
And I think it can be quite easy to look back at a time when more people had more children and, you know, you often had child mortality. And think, oh, well, that's just how it was.
Yeah.
But, like, the grief is...
It's still the same.
So, like, you can't diminish that at all. So it would have been, that is a lot to go through. Mm. And then to leave so early. But, yeah, it shows a massive strength of character, I think, from a very early age.
I mean...
He's eating bannock.
I've got a mouthful of bear meal.
It's really good. It's really good with the mackerel. It's really good with everything.
So... I had to be looking into what was happening in France and Germany at the time that she was going through.
Mm-hmm.
Because she goes on to be, like, this, like, I mean, you might call it radical,
mm-hmm.
but politically active, suffragist, organiser.
She's no wallflower.
No. The interesting things that I found out were that in France at the beginning of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
we have big public... the movement of the suffragist movement, the women's movement in France is almost violent because there's big pushback against them in France.
Yeah.
You essentially have a very socialist government
mm-hmm.
that are bringing in, they're funding the arts, they're giving space for people to, you know, you have great burlesque things that begin to open up, and you have like this, you have Fauvism and cubism.
Yep.
Really interesting
art
things.
Art is changing. Everything is becoming radical in a very quick way,
mm.
which is really interesting.
And there's a movement in the people.
Yes.
On the other side of that, you have Germany,
mm-hmm.
who are also definitely left-leaning, or moving into the left at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yep.
But there's a big focus on nationalism.
Yes.
That turns into something different.
Yes.
A wee bit later on. We're not going to talk
gonna
about then that road.
Yeah.
But also you see women's rights are mm-hmm. beginning to come through in Germany at the beginning of the 20th century. We are seeing children being protected. We are seeing workers' rights being recognised.
Mm-hmm.
So
all the sort of riots and things that had gone on during the 19th century in both Britain and Europe have kind of... The effects that they sowed are having, you know, they're growing now. Mm. It's really interesting. You know, you have like hunger riots, things like technological riots where people would break mills, all that kind of thing. That radicalism early on is now, rather than just being like, oh, we can quash this now, the people have a bit more of a voice.
Yeah. But the next time that we hear from her is when she comes back to study at Glasgow University.
Very good.
Home sweet home.
Home sweet home. Yeah, I've been there for a long time now.
But and actually, when she comes back to Glasgow, she's coming back to a point where It's the precursor to like the Red Clydeside movement.
Okay.
Communism, socialism, workers' rights, housing rights, the lives of people that are living in tenements is being addressed. We have indoor plumbing. People are becoming far more socially conscious. We're painting this picture because it informs who she is becoming.
Yes.
Because she does her master's. We know in 2011 the Orkney newspaper had reported that she had got her master's in Latin.
I love that. Like, I mean, kind of hilarious to do a master's in Latin, thinking about it now. But, like, it's really nice that they put a wee article in.
I kind of also assume that she may have done a few different courses.
Yeah.
Because there's a stretch of time, and some of the records I've seen have said that she graduated in 2012.
Mm.
So I don't know if she got a couple of masters in there or what she was doing. But anyway, it was reported.
And by 2012, we mean 1912.
By 1912. So at that time, one of the biggest movements in around Glasgow is the Glasgow and West of Scotland Society for Women's Suffrage. I'm reading that off because it's a long title.
It is a long title.
But their main campaigns were equal voting rights, the free distribution of information on birth control, and the removal of differential legislation for women in industry.
Love it.
Yeah, essentially, they delivered lots of campaigns, and the focus was about getting the vote for women.
Yep.
But it also looked more broadly at who is being persecuted in society, who needed protected in society.
Mm-hmm.
Things like birth control, I think we think of these as very modern conversations.
Yeah, we do,
But they were talking about it in 1903
and
the need to provide women options.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, this goes on to inform much of the rest of her life. So she then graduates with Latin, and then she goes back to teach in France and Germany. Again, there's a repeating pattern here.
Yep.
What we do know is that all the McNeils speak a lot of languages.
Yes.
So she also has an older sister, Dr. Mary Launchline McNeil.
Wow.
So her older sister, fantastic woman, doing lots of work in Palestine and Uganda.
Wow.
Surgery. She is a very accomplished woman.
Mm-hmm.
We'll hear a wee bit about her later. And the family, again, is moving out. Her brothers are signing up for any war.
Yep.
They are.
As you did, yeah.
They are in the Navy. They are a global family. She then, when she returns from teaching, she becomes the organiser for the Scottish Federation for Women's Suffrage Societies.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think this is one of the reasons that people find her so endearing.
Mm.
She is not in the front. She is not the speech maker. She is not the person kind of seeking glory.
Yeah.
She's always the organiser, the secretary. She is a Dr. Lindsay Middleton of our relationship. The person who gets things done.
Jeezo, if I'm being compared, I'm insanely flattered. What I was going to say is, I think what's really interesting is how she applies herself to causes, which probably weren't at the time very... Obviously, there were causes that were gaining traction and movement.
Yeah.
But they weren't popular.
No.
Like, these were people that were pissing people off.
Yeah.
But, and again, I'm assuming here, but given the way her family was structured, the way they were all educated, it speaks to a certain amount of privilege. And the fact that she's then putting that and her expertise and the knowledge she's gained, the education she's gained behind these causes is, like, quite admirable, because it would be quite easy to just be like, I'm having nothing to do with this. I'm just going to go and have a nice time and study art or whatever in France and Germany.
I think there's definitely comparative Victorian privilege.
Yes.
A wee bit later on in her story, her family are in deep financial straits because of the amount of education they've had to pay for.
Yes.
So she definitely was a woman who had options.
Mm-hmm.
She is a woman who could have found a husband and lived a very nice life.
But she's in no way landed gentry or anything like that. And actually, again, like, quite an amazing thing that despite not being wealthy, her parents / dad later on put that all behind educating the children.
Yeah.
That's quite... Especially at that point in time.
There's lots of writing about the McNeils.
Mm.
And one of the things they spoke about is about how they valued education.
Yeah.
And it shows.
Yeah.
Not only because those who got degrees, but the amount of impact they went on to have as a people.
And it's very, as we were just describing her sister and the work she did, is all very humanitarian.
Yeah.
So there's values there that are driving this that are not self-betterment.
No, and I mean, again, if you have like a dad who's a minister, mm-hmm. a reverend, sorry, and clearly someone who is not so focused on the minutiae of the Bible, someone who probably
believes in the values, believes in the overarching good.
Yeah.
He's not getting stuck down in dogma and,
no.
you know.
My dad was a pastor for a brief moment.
Mm.
So I do feel like there's a level of, like,
you have that
understanding. About growing up in a family where the focus is on the people
mm-hmm.
and being of service to the people
mm.
that definitely has informed, like, my life growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see that that could be the same sort of thing that's just happened in that family.
Yeah.
So as the organiser for the Scottish... Sorry, I need to get this right. The Scottish Federation for Women's Suffrage Societies.
They weren't a fan of an acronym.
No. I mean, I'm sure there was an acronym, but the acronym was...
Snappy name.
SFWSS. Like, it doesn't roll off the tongue.
Swifts.
Swifts.
No. Yeah, they,
no.
They missed a trick there.
There's a moment which I think they're, like... If I had the money to write to create a short movie, like a short film about this.
Someone pay him.
So in 1913, there's a demonstration called the Great Pilgrimage.
Wow.
This is essentially where women suffragists from across Britain
mm-hmm.
are going to walk from their hometown
mm-hmm.
to Hyde Park.
So we're not just talking like, oh, I live in the East End of London.
No.
I'll have a wee walk to Hyde Park.
And I can't guarantee that everyone walked.
Fair
from
enough.
Uchtermuchty yeah. to Hyde Park, but it started in June and ended in August.
Wow, okay, so you could feasibly
yeah.
have done it.
And we don't know if Florence walked the whole way,
mm-hmm.
or if she was already living in London at the time, because she obviously, as a
yep.
secretary, as an organiser, she was, I believe, living in London.
Mm-hmm.
But she carried an Orkney banner.
Mm.
And was photographs were taken of her. And amazing. It was reported in the Orkney newspapers.
Wow.
Essentially, she had become the cover girl for the suffragist movement. Because in London, in Hyde Park, people know about Orkney.
Yes.
And lots of people were talking about from Orkney to
Hyde Park. It's a snappy headline.
Well, it was talking about, like, how the movement had galvanised around mm-hmm. this demonstration.
Yeah.
And it was saying from the White Cliffs of Dover to Orkney.
Yeah.
Women suffragists have made the Great Pilgrimage.
Amazing.
So, I mean, not that this goes to her head.
She doesn't seem...
She doesn't seem the type.
She's not a glory seeker,
but
would you say?
It's one of these points where we begin to see her popping into incredibly important points in life.
Yep.
She's like the Scottish Victorian Forrest Gump, you know?
Excellent.
She's just this background player
yep.
that begins to weave her way into the most important parts of life.
So then we're at a very critical part of British and Scottish history where we're about to break into war.
No, exactly. The suffragist movement takes a step back from campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
Not completely. There is still demonstrations throughout. Most of it is about saying, let us work, please.
Yes, we can help you.
We can let us serve. Yeah. There are demonstrations certainly in London. Suffragettes, I believe, suspend a lot of the militant action.
Yeah.
I will say that Florence was definitely part of the non-militant group of suffragists.
Yeah.
She then becomes the organising secretary on the executive committee for the Association for Moral and Social Hygiene. Again,
Jesus.
Longest...
Jeezy peepsman. Like, let's shorten this down.
But this society is essentially a society that is set up to, like... decriminalize prostitution.
Yeah.
Protect young women.
Mm-hmm.
It talks a lot about trafficking young women and the dangers of drugs and trafficking young women.
Yeah.
Looking for legislation. It essentially looks to say to policemen, we need to stop criminalizing.
Yeah.
We need to start regulating.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be able to have relationships with people on the streets
mm-hmm.
and to support them to make better choices.
Yeah.
We need to provide birth control to stop the spread of venereal diseases.
Yeah.
In 1914,
yeah.
She's talking about the need for protecting young women. She co-authors a report in 1916 on the protection of minor girls.
Mm-hmm.
She's obviously doing a lot. However, at this time, her life gets hit with tragedy again.
Oh, no.
The first one is that there is a rumour, or there is a talk, that she may have had a fiancé at this time.
Okay.
Who dies in the war.
Oh, classic.
We have no note of who this is.
Yep.
We don't have any writing of mm-hmm. them, him.
Mm-hmm.
We assume him.
He, they.
But then her, two of her brothers die in the 1 week.
Jesus.
So stop reading it. You're going to get ahead of the good part, the drama. Sorry. So Willie, her brother, drowns off the north coast of Ireland.
Oh, man.
His body doesn't show up for a week until it comes into Barra.
No way.
Yeah.
Gosh.
And there's a single grave in Barra for him. Patrick, another brother who signed up on the first day of the war, dies from pneumonia.
Oh.
And then her youngest brother, Duncan, was wounded in Palestine, nearly passes from typhoid. He's forced to return home.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know if it's him once he gets home or someone else in the process of him returning home then says to Florence, your dad's died.
Wow. That wasn't my first reaction, but I'm trying to not swear. Jeezo. Yeah.
It was one of these times where, and it was an incredibly quick succession again.
Yeah.
Where you're losing two siblings and a parent.
God.
And, I mean, war is terrible for everyone.
Yeah.
But there's a pattern here in her life where essentially, like, people are dying.
Everything is sort of pulled out from under her feet in one fell
swoop. In one fell swoop. There's a loss. There's a pattern of loss in her life. And at this time, this is where we get to the family without the dad's income are now really struggling because all the money was spent on their education. Gosh. And there's other siblings.
Yeah.
But they don't have the income that's coming in from the siblings that have passed away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there's an imbalance there.
So her sister is working with the Scottish Women's Hospitals, who essentially went in during World War One, when women were told, you're not part of the movement, you're not here to serve.
Yeah.
In fact, the Scottish Women's Hospital was set up by Dr. Elise Ingalls, who went to the Home Office and said, can I serve? I'm a surgeon. I'm really fucking good. Use me. And they said, no, go home.
Can you imagine? The audacity. Wild.
I mean, I believe there was actually, in the British Pathé News, it was reported, I think it was something said, no, go home, darling. Like, have a cup of tea, everything will be fine. And she was like, I'm a world-renowned surgeon. I'm going to set up fucking hospitals.
Sorry, but Jesus.
So she then sets up the Scottish Women's Hospitals. They're on the war front.
It would be really ironic if they're like, well, we're not going to treat men because we're not capable.
No, they were treating men.
Hence the point of the hospital, but yes.
But it's one of these things, as a Scottish person, there wasn't an English women's hospitals. No. There was the Scottish Women's Hospitals. It was suffragists who were campaigning to be allowed to be served that then just were like, okay, well, I'm going to go and serve. And they went, and I think it was the Red Cross they worked with and some other humanitarian organisations, set up surgeries in, occupied countries, working on soldiers, putting themselves in harm's way. Florence's sister, who's been in Uganda, in Palestine, begins to work with this organisation.
Wow.
So, doing incredibly. I don't know if there's money coming in for this.
I would imagine not.
Yeah. And so this is one of the other things where actually there's suddenly a real pressure to support the entire family.
Yes.
And still continue humanitarian work.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that Florence is involved in supporting the wider family. So this is where we get to the end of this first portion of her life. Because what begins next is her literary?
Yes.
Her literary work. Because she writes Iona. A descriptive book, essentially talking about the history of Iona.
Yeah.
Her next book is far more important for us because it's The Scots Kitchen. Now, obviously, you and I have a relationship with Florence Mary McNeill.
Yes.
And we are disciples of her cookery books.
Florence fans, if you will.
Florence fans. I don't know why that made me laugh so much.
We're the Florence fans.
Florence fans. It feels like a very lazy tongue on that. Florence fans. Hello, my name's Ben Gokras. I'm a Scottish historian. I brought some screw booze. A callback to...
Call back to the...
Yeah, that'll be for our true fans who've been here.
Who know the Sirpoos, Lexi.
When I began getting into Scottish food, I saw a YouTube video
mm-hmm.
that had something Scottish chef.
Yeah.
And I clicked on it. And the voice that came forth
mm-hmm.
was a man saying, I won't do an impression of him.
No, let's not do that.
He might hear this.
Well, we hope he does hear this.
I hope he does listen to this. But he spoke about a friend who said, isn't being Scottish and a cook an oxymoron? And I thought, I'm hooked on this man.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was tackling all the things that we were talking about in very serious ways.
Yeah.
But he was talking about it on a House and Gardens video showing off his fantastic London loft.
With great flair.
When I think of this man, I think of flair.
Flair, fabulousness.
Glasses.
Yeah.
A style icon.
Genuinely.
I would like to be him.
I would like to be him too.
You need to make a pretty big decision to become Jamie. I know we're trying to build this up because I'm sure it'll be in the episode title. But I ordered his book that he was promoting on this video.
Mm-hmm.
And the first page I opened to, it talks about Florence Mary McNeil.
Yeah.
And when we were talking about this, I thought, I bet he'd be up for chatting about Florence Mary McNeil.
Because if you are dropping her in your cookbook, and if you are also the head chef of a very famous London restaurant, you probably care about her a fair amount.
Well, he's agreed to talk to us.
Which I am ecstatic about.
Let's have a wee chat with Jeremy Lee. Mr. Lee, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, darling. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. Welcome to the Scottish Food History Podcast. I would really like to start in the beginning. You up in Angus in Uchter House, is that right?
Yeah, the Kirkton of Uchter House.
And your dad built your house in the year you were born.
Yes.
Was that is he laying bricks or is he like overseeing designs?
Oh, yeah, well, that was entirely his design. I mean, yeah. He drew it because he was an artist. And a great chum of his, who was an architect, joined up the dots and made it all work. And he created did all the electrics and, there was no gas back then. Gas now, actually, thank God. I've got a few things right there. It did literally look like a great big block of cheese plonked in the field. That's what it was. And it was at that time that Mum and Dad had my two brothers. Mum was pregnant with me. And they couldn't quite muster the funds to buy a big stone house in Dundee. And it was when, you could buy a piece of land off a farmer for, by a corner of a field. But actually not too much money. So, they could build a huge thing. And the great thing they got out of doing that was this immense garden they could build.
Mm.
In many respects, it works. We grew up in a little fiefdom. Because Angus is so ancient a county.
Mm.
You're living in this very, 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 very ancient place and deeply Protestant. with strange Pictish history. And a very bright modern house with huge windows that looked out everywhere. And then over the years, Dad and Mum, created this extraordinary garden that we played in. So it was lovely. So we went to school in town. We went to Dundee, because there's only 9 miles outside Dundee.
Mm-hmm.
So we went by the foothills of the Sidlaws, and I could bomb into town in the morning. Mum scooped us up when she finished teaching, because she was a domestic science teacher up in Stobswell. Yes, back in those days, why the people don't take food more seriously, I just don't understand. Bonkers. But she would finish school, come and pick us up, and we would drive back home again. Shops, of course.
We have in Paisley, I'm right next to the school where I went to school, Paisley Grammar. They have not had a home ec teacher, I think, for 3 years now, because they cannot find them. And
they're not trained. I know, exactly. Amazing.
Yeah. But that was that was my beginning of everything about food, was actually like leaving the home and then having a teacher who was passionate about food, nurturing that. And that's, I think that's a life-changing thing for lots of people, is when you can learn the basic skills and then get rewarded for,
My home ec teacher used to sort of run a weekly best cook competition, which I found incredibly motivating. I really needed to be best cook every week.
It's a competitive now in the kitchen. But I think it is just utterly extraordinary that we have institutions that teach, you know, the highest level of teaching of all manner of subjects. Cooking is the one, you know, for art schools that are, you know, world-class schools. And for some reason, our cooking schools, the only good ones really are very, you know, in London or in or private.
And they're so inaccessible. I mean, before I decided that I was going to do a PhD in food history, I was like, maybe if this doesn't work out, I'll go to cookery school. I'll like actually train. And I was like, I knew it was going to be expensive, but my mind boggled.
No, it's jaw dropping, and that's just for the tuition. Yeah. You know, no, it's a fraught business. That is for sure.
So, growing up, is Dundee the northeast?
Northeast. Well, I don't know about north. It would say it is. I always consider it the east coast.
Yeah.
You know, Aberdeen's more northeast, and then you get way up, and then you go way up into John O'Groats and all that.
I'm from Aberdeenshire. I was born in Aberdeen, and grew up sort of slightly inland, near Craigiebar Castle, and very similar kind of. I mean, my dad did not build our house. We moved into when I was. Seven, we moved into this very old suitor's cottage that my mum and dad did up, and it was stunning, just really lovely, that kind of pink Aberdonian granite. But it was very similar. We had just this beautiful garden that the majority of our food was grown in, and for me that was my inroad into being passionate about food, kind of having things growing, going and picking things, podding peas and broad beans, and having that kind of connection to the land.
A carrot, for goodness sake, that you've just dug and cooked. Is it tastes like carrot rather than these strange...
It's unbelievable. I mean, I was at home recently, and my mum and dad have moved recently, but they are in the same part of the country, and pulled up a carrot, and the smell hit me instantly, and it was like, if I could bottle that and wear it as a perfume, I would. I couldn't. I was cooking it, but I'd actually sort of devoured two of them before I even got them into the pan of water because they were so delicious.
I don't know if freshly pulled carrot would be a massive seller for...
I mean, you'd be surprised. My perfume is...
It's a complete game changer. I think, you know, it's like picking a squeaky cat, because I think folk take cabbage and carrots and onions as completely fundamental. But most of the time, you don't know how old they are and how fresh they are. And they've kicked around for an age. Whereas if you've just won this freshly cut and dug from the garden, is you know, it's a revelation.
It is. It's absolutely stunning. And I think, yeah, you're right. That kind of, I think that's one thing that when I talk to people about food, there's that disconnect now because we're so used to just buying everything in supermarkets. As you say, by the time you buy a carrot that's been sitting in a supermarket, everything, all that goodness that it gets when it's just pulled out of the earth has dissipated, and it's not the same thing.
Well, you can tell with age because they sweeten with age.
Yeah.
And so that's why, you know, when you make a carrot soup or a stock, you think, why is it so sweet? It's really strange. You know, it's got, where's that? Well, it's that I sent, you know, that almost, you know, snap you get with a great, with very fresh vegetables. My revolutionary.
Speaking of like your garden and where you grew up, was there a sort of particular dish or a memory that you had in childhood associated with food that really sort of got you into thinking about food?
Yeah, no, because my dad's mum was our granny, because she'd just been widowed when we were born. Shockingly young, she was only like 60 or something. It was terribly tragic.
Wow.
So I never met my grandfather or that grandfather, and so she was just corralled into our family, looking after mum and the kids, you know, because mum, I mean, four of them in the new house in Octa House out in the country. So she'd come to babysit one night and then stay for 6 months, so we adored her. It was just brilliant. And you know, like many housewives back then who weren't trained in cooking, had a very small repertoire, but boy, it was, you know, it was mince and tatties, lentil soup, with these amazing little dumplings that just, you know, the right clouds. Wonderful baking as well, fantastic pastry, really great jam making. So it was very, very simple, but very good, really good project. Because the other thing back then is I don't think, you know, and it would be hard to, you know, certainly what free range, I suppose. I'd hesitate to use the word organic. But really, the quality was just something else.
Yeah.
You know, and we just took this for granted. Little, you know, I mean, and there was a generation. And then I think the great revolt of women just throwing in the towel and just going, no, this is, you know, this is a prison sentence rather than a pleasure. You know, and it's really interesting to see how, you know, you come down a few generations later to current times and folk are really beginning to see the sheer joy of spending time in the kitchen. You know, it's a lot more, it's a lot leveler than parking yourself on the couch and binging on Netflix. You know, I'm not quite sure what I'm doing for myself with this. You know, I'm not very much. But it's spending time in the kitchen, you know, you've got the joy of achieving something.
I've been having this conversation with my parents a lot because they, when they were growing up, they had like Sunday roast, Monday leftovers, it might be turned into stovies depending on what was cooked on Sunday. And then there was like soup, mince and tatties, you know, every night I had a dish and they had that their entire life growing up. When they had families, they pushed against that and said, we're not going to be so rigid, but we ate pasta five nights a week or mince and tatties four nights a week. And then I'm very much the same. I don't have any routine, but I have a lot, much less variety in my diet than my grandparents did, because although there was structure, it kept them to a routine and there was space to kind of branch out in there, or a day where they would have something, they would try something different, or my granny would buy a paste or something from a friend that she found at the grocery van who was sharing a recipe for something that was in season and that would get added in. I don't have near amount that kind of variety in my diet. It's just pasta, pasta, toast, beans, paninis.
I mean, my mum, my granny was a wonderful wee Glaswegian woman, very bad cook, but ironically enough, and I think she kind of, you know, she was a dental nurse, she had a career, so she had done the whole, okay, we're not cooking anymore, it's going to be Findus crispy pancakes and whatever sort of ready meal it might be, but the things that she did so well were the things that were clearly passed down to her from her mum. So her broth was incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, she would do just a really good roast, mince and tatties. But ironically, it kind of had the reverse effect on my mum, who's an incredible cook, because from the age of about 13 onwards, she was like, I don't want to eat this anymore. I'm going to teach myself to cook. And hearing her talk about her like early culinary escapades where she's just throwing stuff in with no real knowledge, because there was that kind of weird generational gap probably around the 70s where the lines of communication had broken down a wee bit, is really interesting. But yeah,
did you find, in thinking about taking on a role in the kitchen, can you remember if there was a recipe that you, the first recipe you tried from scratch, or the first time you took a risk in the kitchen?
I don't think it was about risk. It was just, you know, well, we just being in the kitchen was something, it was just a daily part of life with us. Well, our mum spent an inordinate amount of time in the kitchen, because obviously feeding a family of six, you know, that takes up a major amount of time. But, you know, she was holding, you know, she was teaching, and she knitted sewing. I mean, she really was. I mean, I'm looking, harking back, how on earth she did it all. It's just miraculous. You know, and with a very calm, you know, facade. I mean, you know, she did it with great charm and style. They were dead stylish, mum and dad as well, you know. So it's harking back, it's really fascinating. And I think, you know, a pan of lentil soup defines each generation of our family, definitely.
I love that.
You know, as you say, scotch and barley broth, absolutely wonderful. And dishes like that just define, I mean, we just crave those dishes still. And we weep that we can't get them made the way mum did or granny did back then. But we fashion the ones, you know, we make ourselves now. And each generation certainly does their thing. But they're such brilliant recipes. They don't really need mucking about much, you know. And then the other strange thing that, you know, that Scotland has this enormous coastline and has very little fish cooking in its history. And that's where Athenagh McNeil comes in. You know, you start looking at all the, you know, all the dishes that are strangely rejoicing their Gaelic names, like Parton Brie and such, like Cullen Skink. And you just go, oh, right, well, that's what all that's about. You know, and then you start digging. And of course, the more you scratch the surface, you realise there's amazing amounts of dishes that were, you know, made with fish. But they, it's the middle classes who really have a lot to answer for, with introducing fitted carpets and freezers and refrigeration. And saying, oh God, no, I'm not going, you know, I'm going to sit on my fat ass rather than get in the kitchen and do some work. You know, and the servants can do it all. And so this very thwarting Victorian bourgeoisie just going, oh God, no, if you work, you're common. You know, I think was incredibly damaging.
Massively, yeah.
And thwarted everyone. And this idea that you educate people out of doing anything. It was just sort of bizarre. I mean, I'm looking at it even from afar, you go, that I just simply don't understand that. Because most folk want something to do. They need to be occupied. Otherwise, they just go bananas. You know, and certainly one thing that you can always tell by cooks in kitchens, whether domestic or professional, is that they all love doing stuff. Folk, I mean, you know, and you could see it best during the COVID lockdowns when, you know, the cooks, no sooner the dust settled and we, you know, dusted ourselves off with the shock of it all, then we all started cooking like crazy. So it wasn't, you know, there's no question of sitting back and going, oh, well, we'll wait till we get cold again. You know, it's like, well, what can we do? All right, let's feed the NHS. All right, what charity needs some work now? Who can we help? You know, what can we do? And this amazing thing with this enormous food mountain and then this incredible realization of people suddenly started to see just the sheer expanse and scale of the food community within the British Isles. You know, and then you see that globally, you go, it's pretty good and it's pretty big, you know, and impressive.
I think as well, everyone after COVID was like thirsty for connection.
Yeah.
Because we're spending so much time separated from people at really pivotal points in the year, like birthdays and Christmas and times when we would congregate. We were suddenly looking at, like, people were getting into making bread. We wanted to feel connected to the earth. We want to feel connected to our ancestors and to our family when we can't be with them. And I think it's one of those, a case study for food as a vital part of life. Yeah, as a connector, as a cultural exchange.
I turned 25 during one of the years of lockdown, and it was like a birthday. Normally, I love birthdays and I like sort of celebrating them as much as possible, but it was a really strange one. And this is a really like quite a shameful thing to hold up my hand and say, as someone who like I pride myself in being a very good, competent cook, but I'd never actually roasted an entire chicken myself. And I remember I was rereading How to Eat by Nigella, and she has this line and it's like, you could go through life without knowing how to roast a chicken, but why would you want to? And I was reading this and I was like, why would I want to? So on my 25th birthday, I roasted a chicken and I actually wrote about it because it was like, to me, it was that smell. It was the connection. It was that kind of link to family that I couldn't have because I couldn't be with them. And that was sort of, and since I've roasted many, many dozens of chickens to make up for lost time. But yeah, I was so fascinated by the COVID as like people returning to more traditional food practices than we would normally have the time to embrace in fast, busy life.
That was very true. There was something that, you know, that was certainly what happened here. And that's what technically, you know, Craig put the last defining facet to the book I wrote and published then not long afterwards. You know, and it was having a functioning kitchen at home. You know, and I was trying to do it. And yes, it was an embarrass of time to do it. But it was absolutely brilliant being able to just soak beans and make stock and then have pop it in the freezer or put it in the fridge and have things like, oh, right, I've got a big pan of this. What can I do with that on Tuesday? And what can I do with that on Thursday? And it was brilliant fun. And then the next thing, I'm jointing a duck or a goose or something and being that. Okay, this is getting a bit mental, but it's great fun.
I'm going to bounce about here actually a wee bit, because and reading you and just listening to you now talk about all the food chores or the food practices that you got into in COVID and reading about them, I was shocked. Why is there not an audiobook of you reading this book? Because it's so prose. It's got such a great commentary, and there's lots of parts of it I feel like are really strong kind of opinion pieces. It reads like a conversation and you kind of listing off things in a very visual way. Have you been tempted to write or to record an audio?
No, I didn't know. It occurred to me. Gosh, I'll put that on. So that thought. Yes, what a lovely one.
I have to say,
not. I know.
I, I absolutely love listening to Nigella's How to Eat, because there's something, especially when I'm going to sleep, because there's something about her listing the ingredients for some double chocolate brownie fudge nonsense that just sends you off to the land of nod. And I think I would be just as enthralled listening to you talk about Scotch woodcock for a late night supper. Oh,
such a good recipe. It's one of my favorites. Oh,
thank you very much. Bars very deeply. One of my favourites too.
Well, no. Well, let's talk about your journey into food. So obviously, you've talked about kind of you were getting ready to go into art school to follow in the path of your father and your brother, and then you ended up as a terrible waiter, and then were ushered into the kitchen. What was that first day like in the kitchen?
It's a blur. I will be honest, it's a blur because it all happened so quickly, and there was no plan to it. And I didn't really have any say in the matter. I mean, it just sort of, you know, I was just sort of right, you know, you're no longer on the floor, you're in the kitchen. I went, okay. Right. You know, and I was a bit of a dweeb and a bit of a geek, and I just left school. So I'm completely unworldly, you know, and really, I mean, I was only, what, 17 or 16 or 17, you know, I was really young. And back then, that was you were very, very young at that age. I mean, they really did know absolutely squad. So I just, you know, happily found myself standing at a, you know, at a kitchen bench. And Nori and Billy and Mark were incredibly sweet. They just took this little gawky, gauche, awkward, plump pudding of a boy. And I looked like Billy Bunter with this enormous white hat and a big white okay. And they took this little dweeb and very sweetly took me under their wing. And but before you could bat an eyelid, 4 years later, they'd given me an apprenticeship, which I mean, it just flew by. I mean, I still marvel at it to this day. You know, that just, you know, it was literally like you just got on a merry-go-round and off we went. And it literally didn't stop until one morning when Nori, and I think I just had my, I just turned 20 or 21, can't remember. I think it was 21, and he just said, right, what are you going to do now? And I went, oh, God, no, I'm in trouble again, what have I done now? And he said, you know, you're just, you know, he said, you're really good. And I went, you know, nobody had ever said that to me before. I've never, you know, a couple of teachers, you know, who I really did like. But most of my time at school had been just like, Lee, out. But we were constantly being belted. But then we used to just keep silly little notebooks saying, how many beltings did you get today? And it was just so shocking back then.
Gosh.
Wow. And it was quite a Protestant upbringing to see them. And then they sent me to London. And that was my their way of being able to thank me for doing 4 years with them, because it was a very remote little country house to tell me, beautiful, but it was remote and sadly no longer. It's gone back into private hands.
And was that Scottish cookery, or was that
very much so? Very simple, very plain. It really was the heyday of the steak. So it was a thing in an entrecote. You know, a great big sirloin on set, but amazing beef, because it was Angus. I mean, we were right in the heart of Aberdeen Angus. And back then, it really was absolutely fantastic. That's absolutely delicious. And the steaks were these huge, great big things, you know, that it's funny now, they so marked a time for me that, like a burger or a pizza, I very rarely eat steak now. There's just something I sort of conjure it in my mind. And also like fish and chips. But as soon as you tuck into it, you're like, oh, God, you know what? It just doesn't taste the same. Rather that thing about food and harking back to times past, it just doesn't do it. But they were relative, but it was collops in the pan, Cullen skink, very plain Scots cooking, but done really, really well, and bucket loads of stock and mise en place and and pickled walnuts and things like that, which was just, it was lovely.
And so you're obviously coming up through restaurants in London, and you get to a point where you are taking over or creating Quo Vadis' menus. Is there anything you pulled from your Scottish cookery, from your home economics mother, into it? And how did you go about developing the palate of Quo Vadis?
Well, it took a long time. I came from a very bright, bonny place, you know, from Terence Conran. It was all Elizabeth David and Alice Waters mixed in together. There was lots of that kind of thought swirling in the air. as we were finding our way to this brand new, this fantastically new realm that was this restaurant world that had never existed before. It was all very bright and shiny and new. And Corval is very, very old. And we just thought, wow, you know, what? You know, I come from a very, you know, modernist background. So how is that going to translate into here? And so that became really interesting. And it took a very long time to work out what, and then this thing of what British food actually was.
Yeah.
And along the way, and I'd always cooked seasonally. I'd always cooked in kitchens that took seasonality and produce very seriously, and producers were as vital as the cooks in the kitchen and the waiters on the floor. And so that grew bit by bit to be the main thrust. It was just all about produce and simplicity. And of course, the thing is, you say the word simple and it takes days, you know.
Yeah.
A great deal of skill to get this, you know, much is required to orchestrate and choreograph a kitchen to produce this food on a daily basis. And, you know, you're only as good as your teams. The team is crucial. And the part of the team is are the ingredients. And so we were never interested in, you know, highfalutin food. And I was always far more interested in, you know, in France and Italy with trattoria and bistro. So I think that regional cooking I absolutely adored as well. You know, and I just, that just began more and more and more to take over, you know, to be thrust that we took.
So obviously you're building this vision of Covadis. At what point does it pop into your mind that you have enough of an opinion on food and enough to say about food and seasonality and ingredients to begin to write cooking?
Oh God, well, I didn't. I was invited to. Amazing. It was the highest compliment and praise you could get. But Louise Haynes, who is the great brain behind Fourth Estate, the food Fourth Estate, we had, you know, she was publishing Rose Prince when we first met, and, you know, and obviously Nigel Slater, and there's this whole stable of amazing writers, you know, that go way back, and we always seemed to end up sitting beside each other at dinners and just going, and she just said, well, enough talking, dear. You know, now you need to start writing. And that was literally it. And when I started, we didn't want it to be a chef's book or a restaurant book. That just somehow seemed not where this book wanted to land. It wasn't the shelf to be on at all.
One of the things that really strikes me, and I absolutely love the book, I'm surprised to hear that it was an invitation, because you have such a beautiful, distinct writing voice that really shines through. But one of the things I absolutely love about it too is the art. And I wondered how, you know, was it always going to be the way for you that food was imbricated with art? And also, like, I mean, I follow you on Instagram. The Quo Vadis menus are pieces of art in themselves. And actually, my mum, who is a massive fan, and I'm going to just say this now, was in Quo Vadis last year. Yeah, she loves you. She was in Quo Vadis last year. It was the first time she's visited with my dad, and they had the menu that was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang illustrated around it. And she'd said to one of the wait staff, oh, I love that it was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And they're like, what's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang? She's like, well, it's this amazing. So the art is just, to me, that's, I kind of now associate you with this beautiful culinary kind of almost wood lino cut-esque art. And I wondered if you wanted to say a bit more about how you chose to kind of integrate that.
God, you know, happily, because I know John Bonley, has become a great chum. But Julian Roberts, who is a very, very dear friend, and he designed the book. He'd also primarily designed the menus for us, and he's a great old chum. And in fact, kind of, and his lineage is, he's an astonishingly talented, brilliant graphics designer, and had done all the packaging for Coluccio's in the early days when Priscilla was still and Antonio was still together and still alive. You know, so his eye is peerless. And when we did the first menus, and it was an homage to the old boxes, lead menus of old brasseries and what have you, it was the original idea. And I said, God, yeah, I said, we've got room in the middle for, could we put an illustration there or something? And Julian looked up and eyes sparkling as there was this wicked wave about them, and said, I know just the guy who can do this for us. And he's someone I've admired for a long time and I've always wanted to work with. And John was still, you know, it was just something he did in his spare time, amazing stuff. And So that's where the three J's were born. And of course, the three J's is the moniker for Dundee, Duke Jam and Journalism. Except in this in John, Julian and Jeremy.
Oh, I love that.
Wow, okay.
Amazing.
Symmetry.
And it was a very, very happy happenstance. And, you know, and he is unbelievable. And, you know, his work with Dawn's The Walls and, you know, many facets of core violence have got a John Broadley and Julian Roberts stamp on it.
Now, I have, again, will reiterate how profoundly jealous I am, because if I had sat down and said, "What my partner's an illustrator, and we've been talking for years about, I want the front of every chapter to be illustrated and to have this real organic kind of, like vintage, what's it called again, guild cuts. And so, but I would say as well, the other thing that I really appreciated about how you've laid out this book is how you approach ingredients. It's not courses. It's not kind of as linear as lots of other cookery books are, and no offense to other cookery books, it's great for getting into, but you've approached it from ingredients. Is that because of your approach to cooking at Quo Vadis, or is that because you felt that each ingredient needed that chapter, or how did you organize your thoughts around writing?
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, it was really, because originally, to give, you know, some kind of structure to what this book would be, we thought it would be an A to Z of ingredients. And so it was always going to be arbitrary, you know. And on the book that we, two books really spurred it on, one was Julia Child's From Julia's Kitchen, and Jane Grigson's Good Things.
I love that.
Which I absolutely, I mean, I love those. I'm brilliant titles and I love them both. I couldn't use them, of course. You're just like, oh, you know. Selling, I'll go on. But, you know, but anyway, we couldn't go there. And so, as we started, what is an A to Z? What are a list of good things? And that, from that, really, that very simple idea, you know, it's where the structure came from. And we like the, you know, and we quite liked how bonkers some of it got to, you know, just like, actually, it's rather good fun, you know. You could just drop the book and it would fall, wherever it fell open, you know, you'd find something, you would just like, oh, that's interesting, you know. And I liked that a lot, you know. So it was done quite casually, seemingly quite casually, but, it, you know, it had to be done with, you know, such substance that it really did stand out.
And the first page I had opened to when I received the book was Rumple Thumps, just by accident.
love Rumple Thumps.
And caught the name F. Mary McNeil. And we had not yet started working together, because this was mid, was it 2022 the book came out? I think it was Christmas 22 that I treated myself.
Wow. And I was very deeply.
I thought, I thought that I was the only person in the world that knew about Florence Mary McNeil. I was so excited to read it in her name in your book. So, have you made a study of Florence as a Scots kitchener? We did a bit of an I Spy on your book, your lovely page of your bookcases.
Oh God, yes.
To see what
there was mootings of, you know, what are your there they are.
I must apologise, because I was saying to Lindsay, every single one of my bookmarks is a credit card statement, because it's the only things that I have in abundance around me at all times. But yeah, so did you find Florence, has she been someone that you have worked with in your...
Your mum had a brilliant, she loved cookery books and had a brilliant collection and had Mary in there, so she'd always been there. And she was fascinating to dip into, and I read her, you know, I mean, she's as captivating a writer as Elizabeth David. And the thing that's ended, she predates all that considerably. So I think there is this fascinating time after the Second World War where these women really come into their own. And I think it's endlessly fascinating. And I think F. Mary McNeil, you know, because the English are coming in, actually, was Dorothy Hartley, who did the Good Things in England, which is where Jane Grigson got her title from. You know, and food, I'm sorry, no, Food in England. And so I think, you know, there is this, and I do think they seem to think nothing of bunking, spending the night under a hay bale, you know, while they just went out looking for farmers and old folklore and tales, you know, strange, you know, vanishing worlds that they just said, this all needs to be logged, otherwise it's just going to go under the hammer for the developer. So I think she was forever, you know, and also that thing with food, just a keen curiosity and a fascination with it. I think it absolutely seems to... could be a consistent companion to folk while they're exploring food, you know. And I think curiosity is a wonderful thing. And so she knows, I know she was always around. And like, this is, that's mum's copy of the Scots Cellar.
Oh, lovely.
And then that's mum's copy of another little
recipes from Scotland.
There was Marion Field's book, which I put somewhere else. Where's the
other book? Do you have her book of breakfasts?
No, and I'd give my eye teeth for a copy of that.
I have a more modern copy, if you would like, because I have multiples. I will happily send you as a thank you for doing today.
send you a
breakfast. We have some quick fire questions.
Yes.
Absolutely. No pressure, but we will be judging you harshly on these. So I'll get started at the top. What is your morning roll order?
Morning roll order. Or a rowie or a bacon bun.
Right. A rowie and a bacon.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. If you were going to contribute a family recipe to a cookbook or a Scottish cookbook, what would your recipe be?
Lentil soup.
Lentil soup. Excellent.
Perfect. Bread, plain or pan?
Pan.
Pan.
That was sandwich, though.
Perfect.
Okay. What is your favorite ingredient that sits in your cupboards that you just go to every time?
Oh, God. Oh, jeepers. Between oil, vinegar, tinned sardine, anchovies. Tinned anchovies.
How do you have your porridge?
As in the book, I have to say, not cooked with water, not milk, soaked overnight, very gently brought to a simmer and cooked for 20 minutes with pinhead and medium oatmeal.
Delicious.
I love the combination.
Do you have a favourite tonics product?
Tea cake.
Tea cake.
Always a winner. Do you have a favourite Scottish word? the onomatopoeia explanation of
it's an exclamation mark in a noise.
I just cracked me up. Our dad used to just dissolve us to tears. So funny. It was a very mild accent, but it just made, whenever he did it was just cracked us up. just in Scotland in a nutshell for me.
Love that. Okay, finally, do you remember what the first job you were given in the kitchen was?
Oh my God. Jeepers, harking back. At home or at work, I suppose professionally you're asking me, aren't you?
More interested at home.
At home.
Actually.
The first thing I cracked was choux pastry.
Wow.
Well, yeah, the blur of time, that I do remember.
I think mine was
Angel Delight was mine.
Well, that was my sister, you know, we were very different.
No, of course. Well, listen, Jeremy, it has been an absolute delight. I hope we have kept our gushing to an absolute minimum, because the adoration we will pour out for you would be entirely embarrassing. Yeah. But we are very happy to have you on the side of the good fight. So a big shout out for Jeremy Lee's book, Cooking Simply and Well for One or Many. I would thoroughly recommend it as a purchase.
It's a stunning book, stunning title, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Jeremy.
Straight back at you, my dears. Thanks a million. Good luck with it. And here's to more Marion, Neil.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Here's to that.
Take care. Excellent.
Wonderful. Now, that was just about my favourite conversation ever. But we haven't even begun to talk about the life and works of Florence as an author. So we're going to take a break until next week. So please come back and join us for part two, where we'll look at The Scots Kitchen, The Book of Breakfasts, and the legacy of Florence Marion McNeil. This podcast was presented by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. Why are you laughing?
Sorry.
You've never seen me do this bit. This podcast was presented by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. This podcast was produced by Tenement Kitchen. I forgot my own name there.
Would you like me to do it?
Sure. Over.
This podcast was presented by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist, and it was produced by Tenement Kitchen.
Sure. For more information... email hello at tenementkitchen.com. Sure.
And if you would like to sponsor us, please do.